Thank you so much for downloading Making a Killing. I'm Bethany McLean, and I'm cutting through the noise to reframe the stories you know and uncover the ones you don't know. Truth is stranger than fiction. I think about that saying a lot because it has the great virtue of being, well, true. And it's particularly true when it comes to the world of business. I mean, from the financial crisis to Bernie Madoff, you could not make this stuff up. Even with that high bar, the story of Carlos Ghosn stands out. Ghosn, of course, is the former head of Nissan Motor and Renault. He is, was, a revered figure in the automotive world. In the fall of 2018, he was jailed in Japan on charges of financial misconduct. While he was out on bail, he hatched an escape plan that involved being smuggled out of the country, escaping security by hiding in a large black box, which, thank goodness, apparently did have breathing holes cut in it. He's now living in a pink mansion in Lebanon, a pink mansion that Nissan had bought and renovated for his use. I mean, right? Talk about truth being stranger than fiction. So there are at least two sides to this story. The official version, the Japanese version, is that Ghosn stole from Nissan, partly by paying himself more than anyone, including investors, knew. Here's a surprise. Ghosn denies those charges. In his telling, Nissan's Japanese executives wanted to be rid of him and found a horrible way to do it. I have not fled justice. I have escaped injustice and political persecution, Ghosn said in a statement after his escape. For sure, Japan treats white-collar criminals very differently than the U.S. does. Among other things, Ghosn was held in solitary confinement and interrogated for 8 hours a day. The conviction rate is close to 100%. My longtime friend Joe Nocera wrote in a recent Bloomberg piece that Ghosn thought to himself, you are going to die in Japan if you don't get out. So Ghosn took matters into his own hands. Is this justifiable? Or is this a sign of the entitlement of the global elite? And who is Carlos Ghosn? An innocent man wrongly accused? Or a common thief? I began this season of Making a Killing with Joe Nocera talking about Juul, so it seemed fitting to end it with Joe, who wrote this about Carlos Ghosn. When you get right down to it, Nissan and the Japanese prosecutors put a rich, powerful man, a man unaccustomed to being defied, through hell. Now that he has escaped, it's his turn to put them through hell. I'm thrilled to have Joe here to talk about what will surely go down in history as one of the greatest business stories ever.
Certainly one of the greatest escapes ever, that's for sure.
So how did he do it? Let's start with that.
Well, the best part about that is nobody yet knows. For instance, you know, when you think about it, if you make an escape like that, you have to plan it for months, right? Months. How did he find the guy who planned it? How did they communicate with each other?
Well, wait, on that question, is it even a guy who planned it, or do we think it might have been his wife?
Oh, no. I'm pretty sure it wasn't his wife. No, there's a man who's a former paramilitary type who does security, these kind of high-risk security jobs.
This guy Michael Taylor, right?
Yes, that's right. His name is Michael Taylor. Thank you. So how did Michael Taylor get in touch with Carlos Ghosn? How did they plan it so that Ghosn knew what to do and when to do it? It's obvious that they had come to Japan, and they were watching the people who were watching Ghosn. So there was a camera that watched them all the time, and there were people, Japanese, security guards outside. But they realized that there was a certain week in the year when the Japanese basically took the week off because it was their high holidays, their big vacation time, and they weren't there. And they figured that out. And they realized that that was potentially the time to do it. And so, the first round of rumors, I'm so sorry if it wasn't true, was that he had hidden in a musical instrument case for a double bass.
I remember you being so excited about this over the holidays.
I wanted that to be true.
It was too good to be true.
But it wasn't. But, it's kind of pretty amazing what he did. He walked out. He put one of those masks around his face, as many Japanese people do when they're outdoors. He walked about a mile. He walked into a hotel, and then he walked out the other side of the hotel, presumably not being followed, obviously not being followed. And then he got on a train.
Wow.
And he took a 3-hour train ride to Osaka. And once he got there, that's when he was met by this team of people who put him in this big black box. Put him
just
on
that line alone. This team of people who put him in a big black box.
Right. They put him on an airplane, a private airplane. They didn't want to fly directly to Beirut because they were afraid that that would send up too many signals. So they went to Istanbul, right? And then he had to get past, customs, a second round of customs, having sneaked past the Japanese customs. Then he had to get past the Turkish customs. So we went back in the black box. They took him out of one airplane, put him in another airplane, and he landed in Lebanon.
And Lebanon, presumably, he can't be extradited.
Well, Lebanon does not have an extradition treaty with Japan. Also, he is a Lebanese citizen, among his other citizenships. He is a highly revered figure in Lebanon. They even have a postage stamp named after him. I mean, he's one of their few kind of international businessmen. Figures. They don't have very many.
Yep.
And then his wife met him also in Lebanon. So she obviously knew what was going on. So she goes to Lebanon. And then the hilarious thing is this is one of the houses that he had refurbished, renovated.
On Nissan's dime.
Now the question is whether Nissan knew that or not. But he's basically squatting in it. and he's kind of daring Nissan to try and kick him out.
And is it true that it's pink? I don't know why that detail thrills me.
It's definitely pink.
I've
seen it from the outside.
But see, this is why I asked the question about whether his wife was involved, because his wife met him there, so she had to have known.
Yes, that's absolutely true. She had to have known something, for sure.
Right.
But don't forget that he had not been... One of the things that most upset him during his ordeal, and I'm sure we'll talk about that ordeal in a bit, is that he, as part of his bail, he was not allowed to speak to his wife at all. And his children, really, at least one of them, couldn't come to Japan because she was afraid she'd be arrested too. So he didn't have a lot of contact with his family. He wound up speaking to his wife twice with permission and with people listening in. Once was around Thanksgiving and once was around Christmas.
We're going to come back to the conditions of his bail and the conditions of his treatment because it's important both in the micro and interesting in the macro. But what's really interesting about this is we know the details of the escape, but we have no clue how it was planned. And listening to you talk about the monitoring of his conversations with his wife, how did he manage to have communication with the people who helped him escape if everything he said was being monitored?
When he was in the home that he was using in Japan, in Tokyo, he was not allowed to have any electronics, no internet, no television, no nothing.
Wow.
But during the day, he was allowed to go to his lawyer's office where he did have access to a computer and did meet with people. And people were allowed to come and meet with him. So presumably that's how it was done, in person, or possibly over the internet when he was at his lawyer's office.
Although his lawyer says he knows nothing.
I'm sure his lawyer did know nothing. I'm sure his lawyer...
It's Japan, a black eye for his lawyer.
Japan is a country where face matters so much.
Yep.
And he humiliated his lawyers by doing this. Right. His lawyers had vouched for him, and his lawyers were trying to show through his trial that a Westerner could get a fair trial. That was their goal. And, you know, one of the very tiny handful of big-time defense attorneys, I mean, in the U.S., they're all over the place, but in Japan, they're very rare. And this was a moment for these lawyers to try and make the case that Japan could treat a Westerner fairly.
I just wanted to pause on this note. It was from the Wall Street Journal, and they wrote that the planning involved a team of between 10 and 15 people of different nationalities, and that in all, the team took more than 20 trips to Japan and visited at least 10 Japanese airports before selecting the Osaka airport as a weak link.
Right.
I mean, it's a stunning degree of coordination, right?
Right.
Before we move on from this, Michael Taylor, this operative who helped Ghosn, he's a story in his own right, isn't he?
He is. He's done this a few times before. He's actually been in prison for something, when the film gets made, Michael Taylor will have a starring role for
right.
sure.
You can just see that this everything about this is cinematic, right? Right,
absolutely.
Right down to the black box.
In fact,
pink house.
There was rumors. Wall Street Journal printed a rumor that Carlos Ghosn was already in negotiations with Netflix, but he denied it. He denied it.
So tell me more about who Carlos Ghosn is for people who haven't followed the craziness in the automotive industry.
One way to think about it, Carlos Ghosn is the Lee Iacocca of the modern era, the larger-than-life auto exec who performs miracles.
And does he? Is that real?
To some degree, it is. Yes. So here's what happened. Carlos Ghosn was the CEO and chairman of Renault, a French company.
Yep.
Nissan is in terrible, terrible trouble. And so they go to him and they ask him to, what could he do to help them? So what he does is he sets up, it's not a merger, it's an alliance. They remain separate companies, but they do things like they buy supplies together and they do some back office things that save money and they coordinate in various ways. They actually even for a long time split up territories. So like, Nissan was big in the U.S., Renault was big in Europe, they both went to China, and, you know, I said he was the Lee Iacocca. A better phrase might be he was the Marshal Tito of the auto business, because what you had was you had this very French culture, Renault, this extremely Japanese culture, Nissan, and you had this one guy who somehow managed to ride herd over all of it. So then Nissan, he did turn Nissan around. I mean, it was really quite dramatic to the point where Nissan became the stronger of the two companies and Renault became the weaker. But because of the way the alliance was structured, Renault owned more of Nissan, like 15%, than Nissan owned of Renault, which was 5%.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that began to upset the Japanese, not the only thing, but one of the things was that Renault, which had become the weaker company, still had the stronger position on the board and in terms of stock ownership.
And so do most people credit Nissan's ability to thrive to Carlos Ghosn? And is he that guy who was able to pull these companies through an incredibly troubled and difficult time in the automotive industry globally?
Most people do give him that credit.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
He's viewed as a true giant of the auto world, to the point where, as he noted during his flamboyant press conference once he escaped, you know, Steve Rattner approached him during the financial crisis when he was the auto czar, Obama's auto czar, and asked him if he would be willing to come in and take over General Motors.
Wow. Okay. So this guy, he doesn't lack for ego either, it sounds like.
Well, I do have to say, yes, if you've been around CEOs, there's a certain type, you know, larger than life, totally convinced they're right about everything.
Sometimes wrong, never in doubt.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. But really kind of aggressive. He was all of those things. You could sort of see how he would drive the Japanese mad.
And before we come back to that, wasn't he trying to do something with Fiat and Chrysler? He was trying to pull off yet another coup, right?
Yes, he was. He had already brought Mitsubishi into the alliance.
Okay.
He was, you know, maneuvering to bring other people, other companies into the alliance. But the big issue really, really for Nissan was they felt that he was going to not just have an alliance, but he was going to merge Nissan and Renault. And they were dead set against that.
And why? Because they perceive Nissan as the stronger company, or because of Japanese pride in Nissan not wanting to see it submerged or subsumed into Renault?
Both is the answer.
Both.
They're the Japanese are a xenophobic people without question. And there were a lot of tensions within the alliance, even, you know, before this came up, the idea of a merger. And yes, Nissan felt like we're the king of the hill now. Why should we stoop to help, you know, struggling Renault?
Yeah. I just saw this note in here that 6 years after Ghosn took the top job, Nissan had surpassed Honda to become Japan's number two automaker. Its market capitalization had quintupled and its operating margin had risen tenfold. So
In the modern world, that's how you become a legend.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So were there any whispers about him up until the fall of 2018? Was there any talk that this guy was somehow overstepping some kind of bounds? Or was the fall of 2018 when it all exploded out of seemingly nowhere?
There was not so much as a whisper in terms of, you know, whether people thought he was doing things on the sly or on the side or playing tricks or playing games. One of the things that was so shocking about this story is it's as if Mary Barra flew to Canada and was arrested for, you know, stealing from General Motors. That's how kind of shocking this was. And the way they did it, you know, the Japanese Nissan executives who were plotting this with prosecutors, and that is what
happened. They were plotting.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
There's no question about that. You know, they tricked Ghosn's former number two into flying back to Japan, which he had not done in 3 years and was awaiting back surgery.
Wow.
They tricked him. He called, an old friend of his from Nissan called him and said, "Hey, we really need you here for this meeting. Come on, we'll send the private plane." And they did. And he lands and he gets arrested. And then Ghosn has no idea this is coming. He lands and he gets arrested. And that's where they find out. And that's where the world finds out that there were these allegations against him.
Truth is stranger than fiction indeed, right?
It's an astonishing story. One of the problems with trying to grapple with the story is that it's really hard to know, even now, who's telling the truth.
Why is it so hard to know? And his compensation was public, right? These were public companies. And so what was disclosed is knowable, and what he took is knowable. Where does the complexity come in?
So there's a couple of things. The first charge is that he hid compensation from Nissan and the board. This seems, frankly, pretty unlikely, although he did settle with the SEC for a small amount of money, affirming or denying the charges.
Yes, the exact language was that he settled charges that he and Nissan had failed to disclose more than $140 million in compensation and benefits due to be paid to him in retirement.
Right. So that $140 million is a big sticking point. So he and his former number two, his name is Greg Kelly. They say they had not signed off on the deal yet. That they had sketched it out along with some Nissan executives. They had all sketched it out together, but there was no guarantee it was going to happen. It had not been certified. It had not been approved by the board, and so they say there's no there there. Nissan says, you know, you were doing this behind our back. And in so doing, you're violating the Japanese law. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, the second set of charges was that he was, you know, in effect, laundering Nissan's money to put it in his pocket.
Uh-huh.
So the big example of that, the one that he uses is that there was a dealer in the Middle East, and Nissan paid this dealer millions of dollars. And then, according to Nissan, the dealer somehow funneled some of that back to Carlos Ghosn.
A kind of kickback scheme.
Ghosn says it was all on the up and up, that the money that was spent to this Mideast dealer, who he acknowledges was a friend, was not unlike any, you know, upfront incentives to any dealer. So he says, you know, that was on the up and up. And then the third sort of set of charges, it's really more like Dennis Kozlowski's $6,000
shower curtain.
Yes, that's right. It's more like that, which was not illegal, right? But it was a waste of corporate assets, and so he had these houses, you know, literally like five houses that were all renovated for him on Nissan's dime, all supposedly owned by Nissan. His kids all went to Stanford on Nissan's dime.
His kids cut and went to Stanford on Nissan's dime.
Well, but
I want to figure out how to work that one.
He had that in his contract.
Okay.
That they would pay for it. And then the most famous of all, the birthday party for his wife in Versailles.
Marie Antoinette themed, right?
Yes. And then he goes at the press conference he gave, he really went off on that. It's like, We've spent so much money helping Versailles, making Versailles great. Versailles is the place everybody wants to go. Versailles is good for our customers. It's good for our, you know, ad agencies. Da, 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 da.
So he somehow argues.
He was more defensive about Versailles, I think, than any single other thing that he spoke about.
So he somehow argues that hosting a Marie Antoinette-themed birthday party for his wife at Versailles was beneficial to Nissan's brand?
Pretty much. But I don't know that it was Marie Antoinette.
Okay, I read that somewhere. That might be like the musical instrument case, right? Too good to be true. So what does Renault say about all of this? Because you would think they would have a view, too. Are they on Nissan's side or are they on Ghosn's side?
Renault doesn't know what to do, to be honest. Renault's main concern, especially at the beginning, was to shore up the alliance and not let the alliance fall apart. For the most part, that is a losing battle, because without Ghosn at the top, the culture clashes have gotten worse and worse. The board disagreements have gotten worse and worse. And I do have to wonder whether the alliance can survive or not, which will be really bad for Renault. In terms of Carlos Ghosn, they have sort of been tiptoeing towards the idea that maybe there was some wrongdoing, but they haven't really come out and laid out a set of allegations the way Nissan did.
Okay,
so it's still unclear. I mean, It's really complicated for the French because France is in a very anti-elitist mood right now. Macron, the president, is viewed as an elitist. Carlos Ghosn is viewed as an elitist. In a different era, it's quite possible the French would have gone, you know, to great lengths to spring him from prison.
But not today.
They just kind of kept their mouth shut and really hasn't done much of anything.
Greg Kelly, what's happened to him?
Nothing so far.
Is he still in jail in Japan?
No. He was out on bail, just as Carlos Ghosn was, awaiting his trial, just as Carlos Ghosn was. There was some fear that he would be thrown back in jail as kind of punishment or revenge for Ghosn's escape, but that does not appear to have happened. And, you know, on the one hand, this is kind of rough for him because obviously he's not going to get out of Japan anytime soon. But on the other hand, this doubles the Japanese are going to have a really hard time saying this guy should go to jail for 20 years when the ringleader, quote unquote, has escaped to Lebanon. So that actually may work out for him.
So back to this point about how Carlos Ghosn was treated in prison. Tell us about the conditions, first of all.
Okay. So let me begin by saying that there's a phrase for how the Japanese deal with people they're accusing of crimes. It's called hostage justice. And the idea is that the Japanese are not looking for evidence. They're looking for confessions. And that's the way the system works. And that's why they have a 99% conviction rate, because most of the time when they go to court, the person has confessed.
The person is
confessed. And the way they get to you confess is, you know, 11 and 12 hours of interrogation a day, no lawyer present, lights on 24/7, you know, your room is constantly cold, your cell is constantly cold. There's various other forms of, you know, what you might call benign torture. In other words, they're not physically beating him, but they're making his life completely, utterly miserable. And then the way the system works is that after 23 days, they have to either let him out on bail or come up with new charges. And so what they did constantly was they would, you know, wait till the last minute. And just as he was about to be sprung from bail, they throw in new charges. So we wound up spending a total of 100 and some odd days in prison, you know, under these conditions, under these interrogation conditions. And they're always saying to him, you know, if you ever want to see your wife again, you better confess. You know, we're going to make this much worse for you if you don't confess. It's just like, you know, what you would think would that go on in Russia or China.
And the fact that he didn't confess suggests either that he believes himself to be innocent or that he's a really tough
well,
son of a bitch.
I think it takes a lot to resist
or
that.
Both. Yes, yeah. I would think so too. Is there, just to play devil's advocate, and I'm not arguing that people necessarily should be treated like Carlos Ghosn does, but is there any argument that in a world where many people here feel we go too easy on white collar criminals and that people who do damage but are white collar criminals get far lighter treatment than those who are, for instance, in possession of marijuana? And so is there any argument that that might deter the sort of happenings that we see in the U.S. from the financial crisis to Enron to Theranos?
Well, I would never argue that white collar criminals should be denied due process and should be and confessions should be tried to be forced out of them. I would never argue that. To me, the issue is in the U.S. that we don't, our prosecutors have lost the nerve to indict white collar criminals, and that they and the courts, you know, various rulings in court have made it more difficult to bring white collar prosecutions. That's a lot different from what happens in Japan. And really, the outrage about what happened in Japan really had less to do with whether or not Carlos Ghosn had committed a crime than this kind of a new insight that, oh my God, look how their justice system operates.
Right.
It's like, what Western country, I mean, it's not a Western country, but they have Western principles. What Western country treats prisoners like this?
Treats someone not even a prisoner. Treats
right.
someone who's just been accused without even being found guilty
that's right.
in that now, way.
Right. And so here's the other thing I was thinking about this is that, you know, one of the things that happened is that Greg Kelly gave an interview at some point to a Japanese newspaper, and he made a series of accusations about the top people at Nissan, the very people who had plotted against him and Carlos Ghosn.
Wow. And what did he say?
He said that they had padded their salaries and that they had done things, they had done the exact same sort of things that they were accusing Carlos Ghosn of doing.
And say that again, when did he give this interview? Before or after he was arrested?
Oh, no, well after he was arrested.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I think it might have been this past summer.
Okay.
But anyway, the upshot was that the CEO had to resign, that the other people involved had to resign, that they had to pay back some of the money. They were guilty, and they admitted it.
But they got slaps on the wrist because it was apparently in the interest of Nissan that they did this?
No, they got slaps on the wrist because they're Japanese.
That's interesting. So in other words, even that system of laws that it's in the company's interest or against the company's interest
right.
doesn't really apply. It also depends on who you are.
Right. Well, in this particular case, that was compounded by the fact that they didn't want to put the people who were accusing Carlos Ghosn in prison because that would completely undercut their ability to prosecute him.
So is it just a completely ridiculous idea that the justice system should function the same way for everyone, regardless of who they are? And you look
it's
at this.
It's not a ridiculous thing, but you know, that's not how the world works. I mean, it just isn't.
Well, that's one of the larger implications of this story, isn't it? That that's just not how the world works.
Well, it's the larger implication of the Epstein story. It was until very recently the larger implication of the Harvey Weinstein story. I mean, it's the larger implication of the financial crisis story. I mean, the rich people get top lawyers and they can put pressure on that other people can't. I mean, Carlos Ghosn didn't have that going for him, which is a large part of why he decided he had to escape because okay. he had no swag in Japan.
So are you pro or con his escape? I mean, would you say that he saw a set of rules that he thought were unfair and so he used all the resources he could marshal to flee that set of rules and find a different set because he could? Or do you think he should have stayed to face the music in Japan because that's their system of rules and that's, I don't know, what you do?
I agree that he would not have gotten a fair trial in Japan. And I also believe that he was fundamentally kidnapped. And so escaping for kidnappers, even though it's a government, seems okay to me. On the other hand, I really do understand those who say, you know, just because you're rich, you shouldn't get to decide what jurisdiction, you know, you get prosecuted in.
Right. Isn't the essential problem with our world the fact that people who don't have to follow the rules, that people who can pay not to follow the rules can pay not to follow them, right? Where
exactly.
everybody else has to.
Right. That's exactly. And, you know, You have to be very rich to pull off what he pulled off.
So before we come back to how this all plays out, what does it mean for Nissan and Renault?
Nothing good.
Nothing good for Nissan either.
No. Nissan, if you look at Nissan stock, it's just tumbled since this happened. Renault remains a very troubled company. You know, we're in a glut of autos right now. Neither company's doing all that well in China. Nissan's working really hard to, move to electric vehicles. They have the Leaf, which is a fairly popular model.
Yep.
But the range of the Leaf doesn't even come close to a Tesla. And, I think this is a bet that's so far not particularly working well for them.
You wrote this, which is great. Ghosn has been an awful distraction for Nissan, which has cost it dearly. With Ghosn now free to defend himself and to hurl his own allegations at the company, it's only going to get worse. At this point, Nissan couldn't call a truce even if it wanted to, and it can't win either. Nissan has to decide whether it is more interested in pursuing Ghosn or fixing what's wrong with the company. It has already proved that it can't do both.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. Of course, I did write that. So, of course,
so
I think
you better think it's true, right?
But think about it. Nissan has spent so much of the past year and a half just trying to, leak to the press and do this and do that, to throw these allegations out, to besmirch Ghosn. This has kind of been their obsession.
Can I ask a dumb question that I should have asked at the beginning? Why couldn't they just fire him? Why couldn't they just get the board of directors
exactly,
to get rid of him?
Exactly. If that's what's so nuts about this whole thing. Were they afraid of him? Did they think he still had too much power on the board? Right. How do you, when you're sick of a CEO or sick of a chairman, and even if you think he's done something wrong, you fire him? Maybe you file a civil suit. You try to claw back some money. Whatever. It's
worth
not,
their options.
It's not that hard. It's not that hard.
It speaks to either a particular mindset among the Japanese or the fact that there must have been a lot of hatred of Ghosn brewing in those ranks for a long time, or maybe both. Right?
I think there's a third aspect of that though, which is going back to the governance structure, which is that Renault, don't forget, owned 15% of Nissan.
Right.
And so it had an automatic 15% for Ghosn on the board among shareholders if you had to have a vote to get rid of him or not.
Uh-huh.
And I think they may have also feared, because he's Carlos Ghosn and he believes in the rightness of his cause, that he would have put up a huge proxy fight and may not have just lied down and crawled away.
And why does it shake out that he was so valuable for Nissan? Why can't they just rise and conquer without him? Why was this a one-man show?
20 years ago, they needed a visionary.
Yeah.
They truly did. And I think maybe part of his problem, Carlos Ghosn, is that he didn't want to be surrounded by other people who were as smart as he was, or people who were in a position to take over. So his successor, who did turn on him, but who he had groomed, really turned out to be a very passive and not very good CEO. So I think part of the problem was Ghosn was a visionary, but he didn't create a culture of people who wanted to carry on that vision.
And those two don't necessarily go hand in hand, right? The visionary and the person who can create the culture.
Right.
In fact, yeah. Usually they are pretty diametrically opposed if you look at history, I think. It's an interesting tangent to all of this. So what happens now to Nissan and Renault, assuming this nothing good, but how does this shake out?
Well, one of two things has to happen for the companies. Either they have to get together and agree, by God, we got to make this alliance work. It saves us so much money. It'll be a disaster if we try to break it up. And, let's just put our problems, let's put our squabbles aside and get back to basics. Or they will break it up and it'll be short-term disastrous. And I don't know what it'll mean in the long term. They'll probably both get bought.
And amid all the craziness in the global automotive industry, it's that this just adds to the moving chess pieces, right?
It's a terrible time for this to be happening in the global auto industry, especially with we're in such a time of ferment. And when it's clear that electric vehicles are going to be a big deal, but it's unclear how quickly that will come. And the automobile industry has to be ready to move if it does. And these two companies are just kind of mired in their troubles.
And for Gohan, how do you think this shakes out? Well, actually, before we get to him, do you think Japan ever brings charges against the people who helped him escape?
If they could figure out who they are, they will for sure. Yeah, I do think they'll bring charges. I hadn't thought about that before, but yeah, that would.
So there'll be another leg to this.
Yes.
And for Gohan, does he get tried somewhere? Can he live as a fugitive forever?
I think it's very unlikely that he'll ever be tried.
You think, really?
Yes. Right now, he's stuck in Lebanon. He can't leave even if he wants to. He certainly can't leave for any country that has an extradition treaty with Japan. Interpol has a red dot, something out. You know, he's a wanted man worldwide, thanks to Interpol. So he's in a different kind of prison. It's a countrywide prison, but it's still a prison. He can't go anywhere. The Lebanese have actually taken his passport away. So, they've indicted his wife, so she can't go anywhere either.
Japan has indicted his wife?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So they're stuck, but at least they're stuck together. Is there some glorious romance to that?
They're stuck in a country that they're very familiar with. She's Lebanese. I think he's going to be spending the next couple of years, you know, writing a book, dealing with a movie, trying to clear his name. He's rich, but he's not rich like he used to be. This between the money he spent on his defense lawyers and the money he spent escaping. I mean, it's like in the tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, I haven't had a chance to point this out yet, but one of Gohan's frustrations was that he was being paid like a European and a Japanese executive and not like an American executive.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So he was making 15 million or whatever when, you know, in the U.S., he'd be making 40 million.
So there's a global competitiveness issue to this, too, or I'm rich, but I'm not as rich as they are, a relativity aspect to this.
Some would call that jealousy.
Some would just call that jealousy. That's probably a better word.
Right.
So that's interesting. So is this a form of hell in and of itself then, in that this is a guy who wasn't done with the world, but if he does end up ditching a trial and staying in Lebanon, the world is done with him at some point.
I think that's right. He's obviously never going to run an auto company again. The Japanese, unless Lebanon or France decides to try to negotiate some kind of truce with Japan over this, Japanese will never drop the charges. So it's really hard to see how this works out for him in a way that gives him the freedom to go to Davos, to go to the U.S., to find another company to run, etc.
So in a weird way, regardless of what happens, the Japanese won. Though they may never see it that way.
They'll never see it that way. Never. But yeah, he's stuck.
On that note, thank you so much. This was a really fun conversation, and I can't wait to see the movie.
I can't wait to see it either. And then, of course, there's the podcast.
There's the podcast. There has to be a podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you, Joe, for coming.
Thank you.
Well, I, for one, can't wait to see this movie. Do you feel the same way? This story has everything. Money, power, the abuse of power, global intrigue. And there's an entire industry at stake. It seems to me that Carlos Ghosn's time in a Japanese jail and his exile mean that he has and is going to continue to pay a price for whatever sins he has committed. Is it a high enough price? And will Renault and Nissan's shareholders be the ones who ultimately pay more? Stay tuned. Thank you so much for listening to season one of Making a Killing. I hope you've enjoyed it. Follow me on Twitter at BethanyMac12 for news about season two. Making a Killing is a co-production of Pushkin Industries and Chalk and Blade. It's produced by Ruth Barnes and Laura Hyde. My executive producers are Allison McLean, no relation, and Megan Casey. The executive producer at Pushkin is Mia Lobel. Engineering by Jason Rostkowski. Our music is by Jed Flood. Special thanks to Jacob Weisberg at Pushkin and everyone on the show. I'm Bethany McLean. Thanks so much for listening. Find me on Twitter at BethanyMac12 and let me know which episodes you've most enjoyed.